Welcome to a production for the Center for Emerging Media. I'm Mark Steiner. This podcast today, we'll be listening to Joseph Stiglitz, who's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He wrote the book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. This book has caused a huge amount of controversy in the facts and statistics that Joseph Stiglitz has laid out. Before he wrote this book, he served as chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank from 1997 to 2000. He taught at Princeton, Stanford, MIT, and Oxford, and is the author of many books, including Globalization and Its Discontents, Fair Trade for All, and today we're talking about his book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of This Conflict. He wrote the book with Linda Bilmes. So enjoy this conversation with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz about his book, The $3 Trillion War. Let me just start out. There's some overarching issues that have been raised by other economists. I'm sure you've been aware of them since your thesis came out about the $3 trillion war. And this whole argument that war is good for an economy and people basing that on what happened in World War II, especially and to a lesser extent maybe Vietnam, but that war is good for an economy. It fuels an economy, which is one of the reasons that capitalist systems go to war. And that's why the thesis about this being bad for the economy doesn't make sense.
Well, that's actually a question I addressed very directly in the book. I describe it as a myth that grew out of World War II. And at least since the time of Keynes, we know how to stimulate an economy in ways that not only help the economy in the short run, but actually promote long-term growth. No one ever thought that dropping bombs in Iraq was going to help increase the productivity of America, increase our living standards. But there are ways of spending money that can both stimulate the economy in the short run and lead to long-term growth. Now, every category of expenditure has a different, what we call a multiplier. How much extra stimulus to the economy do you get for every dollar of spending? War spending in this war probably has among the lowest multipliers, is the least good that you could have imagined. Let me just give you an example. You spend money on a Nepalese contractor working in Iraq, and contrast that with spending the same dollars in the United States on health, education, or infrastructure. Absolutely no comparison about how much addition to the strength of the U.S. economy. Spending money at home just adds that much more. The Nepalese contractor is not going to be spending very much money in the second round on American goods. The people that they spend the money on aren't going to be spending on the third round on American goods. And so it just doesn't help the economy very much.
So then extrapolate from that how the globalized economy, the intertwining of the national economies throughout the globe affect this process of how we spend money in this war?
Well, I mean, obviously some of the money that is spent in Nepal or Iraq is eventually spent on imports, and some of those imports are imports from the United States, but relatively little. We aren't producing the kinds of export goods that are going to Nepal or to other countries. So we benefit indirectly, but only to a very limited extent. And that's where the concept of the multiplier comes in. How much extra total bang do you get for every dollar buck? And that's why this war spending is so bad. There's another point I wanted to make, why this particular war has been very bad for the economy, and that is because it's been associated with an increase in the price of oil, and that higher price of oil means that we're spending more money Saudi Arabia and Kuwait for oil than money that otherwise would have been spent largely on goods made in America. So again, it's taking away purchasing power out of America's hands and putting it in the hands of somebody abroad. And that's bad for the economy as well. So, you know, no matter how you look at it, this particular war is not very good. It's interesting that people go back to World War II because in the first Gulf War, You look at the testimony of Alan Greenspan at the time, and he was very clear that he thought the Gulf War was one of the factors contributing to the slowdown that the American economy was experiencing around that time. So he saw the first Gulf War as having a negative effect on the economy.
But you mentioned oil a moment ago, and one of the some of the criticisms I've read after reading your book of, that Krugman and others have made, and a recent piece was New York Times just last week, over the weekend, is that this war has very little to do with the rise in oil prices. That in effect, it's really the competition we're having with China and India, expanding that, and that's causing the crisis in oil prices going up, and speculations by hedge funds, and very little to do with the Iraq war.
Well, I just wish people would have read our book, because we anticipated that argument like we did the other one. First, we point out that to be conservative and to avoid that kind of quibble, we assumed in our book only $5 to $10 of the $75, $85, $90 increase in the price of oil was attributable to the war. So in our $3 trillion estimate, we're in a sense agreeing with those critics who say it's relatively one part, but only a relatively small part. In my heart of hearts, I really think it's much more important. And let me try to explain how we addressed that question in the book, and we anticipated those questions. Futures markets are the kinds of markets where people who study demand and supply of oil try to figure out where the price is going to be. And not surprisingly, if you're betting your money on where the oil price, you look at sources of increasing demand. Futures markets in 2003 anticipated that the price of oil would remain around $25 a barrel for at least the next decade. They knew that China was going to be increasing its demand. They knew India, other emerging markets were increasing their demand. You read the literature at the time, and there are no big surprises between what they anticipated and what has happened. Maybe it's going a little bit faster than they anticipated, but you'd have to have your head in the sand to think that China wasn't growing in 2003. You know, that's old news. What they anticipated, and again you go back to 2003, what they anticipated was that there would be an increase in the supply of oil keeping up with demand from the low-cost providers. The low-cost providers are in the Middle East. And the war changed that equation.
How did it change the equation?
Well, there was an immediate effect, of course, in the interruption of the supply from Iraq. That was probably the most immediate and dramatic, but it introduced a huge new element of instability into the Middle East. And that meant that it became less attractive to invest more in this region, to increase the capacity of this region to supply oil to the rest of the world. There's another aspect of this that's a little bit more complex, and I didn't get into in the book as much as perhaps I should have, and that is the dynamics of the oil market. This is not an ordinary competitive market. The oil fields are owned by governments. The governments have a certain amount of revenue that they need to conduct their operations. But when the income goes up much faster, they have a problem of what to do with their extra money. Prices of oil have increased fourfold. That's given them more than enough money to meet their budgetary needs. It's given them a new problem, where to place their money. And where to place their money has become particularly fraught for the countries in the Middle East, because the U.S. is not viewed as an attractive place. There's a lot of hostility, a lot of regulations, a lot of were anxieties about whether if they put their money in the United States, will they be able to take the money back again. The upshot of all this is that there is what economists call it a backward-bending supply curve. When the price goes up, they don't increase the supply. They actually may hold back the supply. They're deciding increasingly that the best place to put their money is below the ground. In other words, keep the oil below the ground where it's secure, it's on their own territory, they know what, that they control it, rather than invest and put it above the ground. It's particularly true with the way the Bush administration has been putting pressure on these countries like Saudi Arabia. In the past, Saudi Arabia kept a certain amount of excess capacity. It used that excess capacity as a way of, you might call it, disciplining the market to make sure the cartel acted as a cartel. If people started producing more, it could then there was agreed allotment. It could let flood some of the excess capacity, and that would depress the price, and they would be taught a lesson. Now, if they have any excess capacity, they are under enormous pressure to produce up to their capacity. How do they respond? Making sure they don't have any excess capacity. How do they make sure they don't have any excess capacity? Not investing very much.
So are you saying, in fact, that at this moment, because I mean, in your book, you don't go into that, but you do go into where the money from the Middle East is being invested rather than being invested in the United States. But are you saying that there, at this moment, it's concrete fact that there's a lack of investment in oil in the Middle East at the moment, and that they are actually holding down the production in for Middle Eastern countries? Is that happening now?
Well, it's very clear that they have not been expanding production as much as was anticipated, as much as would be needed to keep the prices down. If they were investing more, the price would be lower. Now, we went through a very difficult period because of the instability in the Middle East that was exacerbated by Iraq, where a lot of people felt uneasy about putting a lot of money in the Middle East. So there were effects both on the side of the countries that control these investments, but also on investors who are willing to risk their money. There's one other factor that really makes things much more complex, or two other factors. One of the factors is that there has been, until rather recently, a worry that what would happen if peace broke out? If peace broke out, the price would fall from $80, $90 back to the more normal $25, $30, $35 that people had expected.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean that if you invested in shale and coal sands, which can produce oil, say, at $40, $45, you would take a bath. You would lose your money. So you had this irony that while the price was above many of the sources of the cost of production and many of the alternative sources of supply, because there was no guarantee that the price would remain at this high level, it didn't pay for them to make these long-term investments that are necessary.
Let me go back to the kind of focus and the thesis of the book and your chapter on cost of war that the government doesn't pay, which is, I think, where you lay out that's kind of the centerpiece in many ways. That when you total up and describe for people listening to this today, how we get to your $3 trillion. And you have this really interesting chart on page 112 where you kind of go through it. It's really kind of clear there. If we could go through that a bit. I'd like to kind of just walk through it so listeners could understand how you came to this thesis. Conclusion, I mean.
Sure. Let me go through it very simply. I mean, you begin with a budgetary cost, and then you add the costs that go beyond the federal budget. And the budgetary cost, you divide into two categories: the amount that we've already spent. We're spending $12 billion a month on operations. And so we're talking now the $600 billion that have already been appropriated and are quickly being spent for the operations. Then the next piece of money is money that has been spent on the operations but not labeled Iraq. So, for instance, or let me put it more generally, increased cost to the military from the war in Iraq. One example of this is that we have to pay a lot more to recruit our troops. To we have to pay a lot enlistment bonuses, re-enlistment bonuses. We have to repair equipment that is used up but doesn't get repaired in Iraq, comes back to the United States. Much of it does not come back, but some of it does get come back and get repaired here. All of these are costs that help explain why the defense budget beyond Iraq and Afghanistan has increased by $500 billion in the last 5 years. So we attribute one quarter of that to the Iraq war. Okay, these are the operations. And then the second piece is the future costs. Now, the future costs are consist of basically four categories. The first cost is the fact that war is continuing to go on. We use conservative projections from the Defense Department, CBO. Basically, we take a scenario, set of scenarios where which has us having some presence through 2017, though there will be a disengagement in active fighting. Then there's the second cost of demobilization. When we leave, there's an enormous amount of equipment that we've shipped over there. We have to bring that much of that back. Third is all the military leaders recognize that we have been depleting, using up our equipment far faster than we've been repairing it and replacing it. These are called technically the reset costs, restoring the military to its pre-war strength. That is going to be very expensive. But the biggest single cost going forward on the budget is the veterans. And just to frame that, we are spending, remember the 100-hour war, the first Gulf War, we are spending now $4.3 billion in disability compensation for the veterans of the Gulf War. Now, you imagine if that's what disability compensation costs for that short war, a war that's lasted 5 years, much more intensive fighting, involving 1.65 million American troops already, how much that is going to cost. That's the disability compensation, our obligation to pay them. People are coming back with 5 to 8 disabilities, far more than in previous wars. The ratio of disability to injury is 15 to 1. Previous wars, 6.5 to 1. We estimate the cost of disability compensation plus the health care cost conservatively will be in excess of $600 billion. This is an unfunded entitlement, huge unfunded entitlement, that is going to be costing taxpayers for decades. World War II veterans' payment cost to them peaked 48 years after the end of hostilities. And so we can see these numbers going on for a half century or more.
So you can really see, I mean, one of the things that the book said to me very clearly in the conversations we've had with other journalists before this, people like Joshua Kors and others from The Nation, is that you can see why the government is battling even paying the veterans' benefits, saying that 20-odd thousand have pre-existing conditions. There are 60,000 veterans coming out in L.A. news conference yesterday talking about they're not getting proper benefits. And that battle is beginning now.
Exactly. In fact, we describe very clearly the you know, after the soldiers come back from the battle in Iraq, they have a battle with the bureaucracy, a backlog at the current time of over 400,000.
Right.
So, I mean, that's not just a battle. They just say, you know, you have to wait your turn. I view it as a moral, morally, you know, whether you're for or wrong, against the war, you shouldn't treat those who fought for their country, risk their life in the way that we've been treating them. And it comes basically out of the fact, you know, it's not a question of whether there are legitimate or illegitimate claims. As late as 2005-2006, the Bush administration's request for the Veterans Administration was based on numbers from 2002 before the war, as if there not a single injury had occurred. So the fact is that even in the Gulf War, we did challenge many of the people claims that were being made on disability, and eventually disability was approved for 39% of the returning veterans. 39% are on or have been on disability. I think in this war the number will be larger. They may try to challenge, but the fact is these are real disabilities. And the most costly ones, of course, you can't, you know, somebody lose a leg, has PTSD, you just can't really challenge it. 52,000 of those who've already come back have been diagnosed as with PTSD.
So when you look at this, the war and the cost of this war at the moment, I mean, and we are now in the middle of, we're in this recession, and the economy is in trouble, and we've been looking at what happened with the housing crisis and how that's affected financial markets everywhere, and how it's affecting our economy. So, if you look at the money we're spending on the war now, and people are talking about we need an economic stimulus of some kind to fuel and push this economy to move forward, whether it's building infrastructure and many other things in America that can't happen because of the war, and then the long-term costs of the war and even getting out of Iraq. So, talk a bit about what do you see happening? What is the scenario that America may be facing given the costs of this war, the way you analyzed it?
Well, one of the distinctive features of this war is that it's the first war in America's history that has been purchased totally on the credit card. The country had a deficit when we went into the war, and then President Bush asked for a tax cut for rich Americans just months after the war started. He got the tax cut. And so we borrowed every cent. And it's the first war since the Revolutionary War that we've had to turn to foreigners to finance much of it. 40% is coming from abroad. Now, that means, like it or not, our standards of living are going to be lower because we will have to repay in one way or another these debts. You know, the president may have tried to convince America that they could have a war for free, and the economists say there's no such thing as a free lunch, and there's no such thing as a free war. Now, the way it's impinging on the current macroeconomic problems, there are several ways in which it's having impact, but the easiest way to see that impact is what President Bush's former chief economic advisor, Ben Bernanke, who's now at the Fed, has actually pointed out. In 2001, we had an economic downturn. Then we had a 2% of GDP surplus, and that gave us room to maneuver to deal with the problems. The deficit this year is likely to be the largest in America's history, likely be $400 or $500 billion. That just means that we don't have the room to maneuver to do the things that we need. And that goes back to your first question. Spending on Iraq doesn't stimulate the economy in the way that spending on infrastructure, and it doesn't have the long-term benefits. If we expend some of the money that we spent on Iraq building a New Orleans levee, we would have saved lives, we would have saved money, would have been it was known that there was a problem.
So let me ask you this before we have to part. What are the questions that the presidential candidates have to be asked and must they answer that they're not being asked about the future of the American economy and what their role as president should be, given all the things you've written about in your book?
Well, the first question, let me link it with a war. One of the candidates is saying we need to stay the course. We're now spending $12 billion up front. If you include the cost of the disability, repairing the equipment that is being deferred maintenance, We're talking about $25 billion a month. Since the beginning of the war, that monthly charge has gone up from $4 billion steadily. It's tripled. So now the first question is, if we're going to stay the course, that means we're going to have to spend more money. So any candidate that says, I want to stay the course, he's really saying, I want to be spending upfront not $12 billion, but $16 billion, $20 billion. Where are we going to get the money from? What is he going to cut out? Is this just going to be more deficit spending? Or does he believe in, you know, manna from heaven, because the money is just going to come out somehow? The second question is, how is he going to deal with the problem of the millions of Americans who are about to lose their homes and with them their life savings? How is it conscionable for the federal government to bail out the share owners of Bear Stearns? They walk away with over $1 billion of money. They walk away with $1 billion of money and leaving American taxpayers at risk without a dime of insurance premium on bearing that risk. How is it possible for that to occur and at the same time to say that there's no money to help those at the bottom who are losing their homes, worrying about moral hazard at the bottom but not moral hazard at the top? They have to come up with, I think, a coherent philosophy of how you deal with those two sides of our financial crisis. And third is, the economy needs a stimulus, absolutely no doubt about it. But when you think about a stimulus, where are you going to have the biggest bang for the buck? Spending money at Rock is not the biggest bang for the buck. Tax cuts are not the biggest bang for the buck. And as you think about a stimulus, think about what are the long-run needs of America. The tax cuts that President Bush put in place are mostly designed to encourage consumption. America does not have a problem of an inadequacy in consumption. Our savings rate went down to zero.
Right.
In some quarters, it's negative. Anybody who's serious about the economy has to say, how can I stimulate the economy today and address some of the very, very serious long-run needs that are society, our economy faces.
So how do you do that? I mean, what I'm really curious about here in the conclusion of this conversation is your thoughts on what America is going to have to wrestle with over the next 4 to 8 years with a war that's cost this kind of money, with $500 million in debt rising every year in America from the federal government, with foreign invest owed to other countries, and the infrastructure needs. How do you put your hands around that? How do you create a stimulus? How do you create a tax structure in this country that answers the needs that we have? I mean, it's the most presidential candidates and politicians in general are loath to deal with this because the answer is not sweet.
The answer is not sweet, and it's going to take a lot of changes. First, we have to withdraw as rapidly as we responsibly can from Iraq. It is a drain on our economy that doesn't stimulate our economy. It's a drain on our budget, but with very little benefits either in the short run or the long run. Second thing, we have to restructure our tax system. In 2001, 2003, we gave very big tax cuts for the rich, and we did nothing for very little for the average and poor American. If we raise taxes on the rich and adjust the taxes in the middle, maybe even lower some of the taxes in the middle, we can actually lower our deficit and stimulate the economy more. Thirdly, an example of where our tax structure is so unfair and where our public policy is so unfair, poor Americans are having a hard time staying in their homes. The fraction of Americans that will be the homeowners will be lower by 2008 than it was when President Bush became the president. Everybody says it's good, a lot of reasons to have people own their home, good for a whole variety of reasons. Well, the tax system basically gives a huge tax subsidy to upper American income, upper Americans to own their home, about 50% of the cost. Interest is tax deductible, property taxes are tax deductible. doesn't help the people at the bottom at all. We need to have a system that treats the rich and the poor at least equally. And that means if we're going to help the rich people own their homes, we ought to help the poor people. If we do that, we won't have as many foreclosures, and it will help the economy in the short run, even as it strengthens the fabric of our society.
But as we conclude, but if you put into that, some people say we have to have a universal health care system, and we have to invest billions and billions of dollars into infrastructure, whether it's the infrastructure for cyberspace or rail or bridges, as well as schools, housing in the cities. I mean, that the cost of that alone is hard. At least I don't know what the cost would be, but it's huge for America. So where does that come from? How do you reinvest in America that way?
You're absolutely right. We have to reinvest in America. 42%, more than 42% of your tax dollar is in one way or another related to national defense. Much of that is going down the drain in Iraq. But even the part that isn't going down the drain in Iraq is going for weapons that systems that don't work against enemies that don't exist. The Cold War was over in 1989, and yet the way we spend defense dollars is very much the same. We have the same kind of missile systems that we were worried about when there was an attack from Russia. But Russia is not able at this juncture to maintain that attack. If we continue to act aggressively to Russia, we may stimulate them. But at this juncture, they don't have the capability. So we really need to be, you know, we're spending $500 billion a year on defense systems that clearly we could get more security for a lot less money. They've been given almost a blank check, and we've seen that in Halliburton, the profiteering that's been going on in this war, and that's just made apparent a much deeper problem in that Defense Department budget. So, yes, I care about security like every other American does. The real question is, that's not a reason for a blank check. When we were fighting World War II, there was a Truman Commission that went around and said, you know, if America Americans are going to sacrifice their lives, at least we want to make sure that every dollar we spend is spent well. We haven't been doing that. We've basically turned a blind eye to profiteering. And the result of that is that we are getting less security for more money. As you look at it, that is the single piece of change that we need to look at and look at very carefully. That combined with the huge tax cuts for upper-income Americans that were given in 2001, 2003, that did not lead to more investment in America. That was the whole theory behind it. It didn't work. The supply-side reactions did not occur. Labor force participation is now lower than it was 8 years ago. Savings rates have plummeted to zero. I don't see how anybody who says, you know, this was going to lead to a supply-side response, you look at the numbers, didn't happen.
Joseph Stiglitz, I appreciate you taking the time with us today, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we can do it again at some time.
It's been a pleasure for me, too.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Bye.
You've been listening to a production from the Center for Emerging Media. This podcast was produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy, and engineered by Andrew Epic. Thanks to Clean Cuts Music and Sound Design for studio space. And from the Center for Emerging Media, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.